southwestern Indiana really is the only part of the state that doesn't have reasonable interstate access.
Bloomington and Monroe County clearly do not need this I-69. They're doing very well without it.
It's all part of trying to create a climate of opportunity in this state.
It's a boondoggle, and it's classic pork barrel.
The environmental impact statement is the most extensive one that the feds have ever done. So I think they've got it right.
If you listen to the mayors along the proposed I-69, it sounds like we're going to be building about 50 new Toyota plants in the next 10 years.
When I think about I-69, I think, again, jobs first.
It will be a financial drain for decades and decades. That's guaranteed.
From WFIU WTIU News, this is I-69, Are We There Yet? I'm Sarah Whitmire. More than 1,600 miles from Canada to Mexico, 8 states, billions of dollars, and the idea for Interstate Highway 69 started here, Washington, Indiana. It was a chance breakfast in 1990 that brought David Reed and David Graham together.
We all met in my kitchen, and I gave them all omelets.
Reed was on assignment with the Hudson Institute, an economic think tank under the leadership of future governor Mitch Daniels. It was Reed's job to look at ways to bring economic development to southwestern Indiana.
I was fortunate to find a bed and breakfast that was in Washington, Indiana. And it was owned by a fellow named David Graham. And this was actually purely serendipitous. But it turns out that David was not only the proprietor of this absolutely beautiful bed and breakfast, but he was also an activist in the community. He and his family for generations prior to him had been working very hard to try to ensure that Washington and the region around it had a vibrant economic base and was a thriving community.
David Graham, as it turns out, was an important businessman in the area. His family had thousands of acres in Washington and Davies County. They owned several turkey farms and a dairy business. His family's legacy extended to the 1800s. The Grahams settled in Davies County only a couple of years after Indiana became a state. They were early pioneers in the automobile industry. They made trucks for Dodge, and they manufactured the first Popemobile.
We were left out of the highway system when it was formulated, I guess by accident, because it's clear that I-69, it goes from Michigan down to Indianapolis, should have been continued on south.
Washington needed a road. David Cox led economic development efforts in the region.
And if you was not close or had access to a rail, you wasn't gonna survive. And so then that need began to change back over to trucks.
Cox remembers giving a tour to a company thinking of locating in Washington. Flying over the city, they looked down and asked, "Where are the roads?" The winding, two-lane country roads cutting through farm fields looked like a great place to take a country drive, but not an efficient route to move goods or people. The company chose not to locate in Washington.
And that's why it becomes nearly a passion with us to at least to try to get back even, to get to the point where we got a four lane to go someplace.
Matt Dellinger spent 8 years researching the highway and literally wrote the book on Interstate 69.
It has a lot to do about perception. So if you're a company and you want to locate your business somewhere, build a Toyota plant or a Walmart distribution center, you want to be within X miles of an interstate. And some local economic development guy can come to you and say, well, you would be within 2 miles of this divided four-lane road, which is perfectly nice, but you know, they kind of have their checklist. It's meaningful from an economic development point perspective whether you're a U.S. highway or an interstate. That's a big difference.
The folks in Washington, as well as their neighbors to the south, had been dreaming of a highway from Evansville to Indianapolis. But a federally funded study in the late 1980s by Chicago-based Donahue and Associates made that seem all but impossible. The study suggested the cost of the highway would not justify the potential economic benefits it might bring. That didn't surprise the economist David Reed. In fact, he agreed.
And he looked at the route, and he looked at us. He said, Graham, there's only one way you're ever going to get this road built or even started, and that is to get other states involved. Because without other states, you won't make any progress in Washington, D.C.
If the road were confined to Indiana, it would never get the federal support necessary to get it approved. But according to Reed, if it was a major north-south interstate connecting Canada, Mexico, and the United States, then the lawmakers in Washington, D.C. would be interested in a road through Washington, Indiana.
Looking at the map, seeing that that linkage didn't currently exist, seeing that at the time the North American Free Trade Agreement was still on the table, had not yet been signed, but if it were to be signed, that would change the trading terms among the three countries. And yet there was no infrastructure to support that initiative either. So it just seemed to me to make eminent good sense to be exploring that option. And that's what we sort of threw out on the table that morning.
The group was confident the potential economic benefits that a NAFTA superhighway could bring would justify the road's costs. Costs that were questioned in the Donahue study when the road was only an Indiana highway.
They understood almost intuitively that to take it from a regional context to a national and international context would have benefits that far outweighed the costs associated with it, and that would still have the kind of impact that they wanted in support of their regional economy and the area that they were most directly concerned about.
The timing for this idea couldn't have been better for the highway supporters. Politically, the stars were perfectly aligned in Washington, D.C. During the 90s, some of the most powerful federal legislators were from I-69 states. Dick Armey was from Texas, as was Tom DeLay. Trent Lott was from Mississippi. Al Gore, the vice president, was from Tennessee. And the president of the United States, Bill Clinton, was from Arkansas. The expanded I-69 ran through each one of these states. It would eventually link Canada to Mexico while running through Washington, Indiana, creating the largest free trade area in the world. Tom Baumert was the mayor of Washington at the time. He immediately saw the good fortune an interstate could bring. Faster commutes, no more getting stuck behind trucks, no more school buses bringing traffic to a standstill. Fewer accidents because people wouldn't be driving winding country roads, and no more companies passing over his town because there wasn't access to good roads. The boom days Washington saw in the 1800s would return, but this time an interstate rather than the railroad would be the driving force.
If you can get the manufacturers in here and located here, what do? They spend money in your community. They buy your cars. They buy tickets to the various functions. They buy all their groceries here. You can develop stores that they'll be buying product in. So you need something to draw them here to get them here to begin with. If you want to have an impact someplace for your kids to stay and work or your grandkids, you've got to get industry into the place. You've got to have these nice office jobs for the educated kids and grandkids and a reason for them to return to Washington to go back to work.
Safety was also a big reason for wanting the road when you consider the number of semis in this area each day hauling everything from grain to coal and even dangerous ammunition leaving the Crane Naval Surface Warfare Center, a nearby military facility.
I know years ago, when they were first moving ammunition through here to go to the Desert Storm, they called me to let me know that at 2 o'clock in the morning there are going to be 15 semis come through your town. Well, I lived just one building away from the stoplight that they were going through, but they had to let us know to be prepared. The lights are all going to be on flash and they're not going to stop or anything. They're going through, but if one of them would blow up, they have about an 8-block impact. So if they're up on an interstate, we can all feel a lot safer.
Again, David Cox.
The federal people begin to allow longer semis. And as these semis get longer, then it's more dangerous for them to be out here on these two-lane roads. my wife and I ride motorcycle. That's our hobby. And you come around a curve and there's a semi partially over in your lane. All too often, those issues come up and there's been folks that's been hurt pretty bad. It just increases the safety. And when we send our people out, we kind of like to have them back every night.
Research from the Federal Highway Administration shows the fatality rate on the nation's interstate system is about 60% lower than that of all other roads. A report from 2001 estimates that in that year, 6,000 fatalities were avoided because of the country's interstate system. So with the local goals of economic development and improved safety, and the national goals of improving international trade, the folks in Washington began their crusade to build I-69.
So then we decided we had to get the senators and stuff on board, so a group of us went to D.C. and we were going to meet with Senator Lugar one day, and we went over there at our appointed time that we thought we had. Turned out it had been changed, but nobody had notified us. So we go in and she says, "You can't see him. He's in with a bunch of generals from some foreign land, I think maybe even Panama, I think it might have been." But she said, "Your appointment had been changed till this morning. You should have been here this morning." So David Graham, who was our right arm of everything, and a pretty good politician, unbeknownst to me, I guess, handed her his card and said, "Would you tell Senator Lugar that I'm out here?" And it was almost immediately that he came out escorting these generals to sit in the waiting room while he took us back to talk to us. You know? And I thought, wow, I believe this guy is politically connected. So. Then we talked for a long time, and he emphasized the same thing to us. He said, "Yeah, I think it's a good idea to be international with it, and I think we can get the backing, but the first thing you've got to do is get your governor's backing."
David Graham started making trips up and down the proposed I-69 corridor from Canada to Mexico, stopping in small towns, talking to people who worked at Chamber of Commerce offices or who were politically connected, and helped people envision the good fortune that could come from building a NAFTA highway.
My father had the philosophy that if you call on a company, you start out with the guy that opens the door, because if you don't have him on your side, you'll never get the next man and the next man until you get to the person you need to talk to. So I talked to an awful lot of doormen and an awful lot of clerks along and secretaries along the way. The amazing thing is that they're the biggest help you could possibly have, because they keep jabbing their boss. "Look into this, what Graham says. Maybe there's something to it." Because it would mean an improvement to their job, more money for them.
He was very well connected politically, and he also was very good with the financial community. David had credibility wherever he went. So the more we got into this, the more that David, more of a role that he played.
U.S. Senator Richard Lugar.
The southern portion of it has been championed by people in Evansville for as long as I have been in politics. It's been championed by others at various stages, but with less enthusiasm.
Miles northeast near the college town of Bloomington, Indiana, Thomas and Sandra Tokarski were actually sleeping a bit more soundly. They thought a planned regional highway that would have cut through their backyard was off the table after the Donahue study found such a project was economically unfeasible.
The Donahue study was published, I guess, in 1990. And it came out, and they had looked at several different possibilities, and they did not recommend any of them, basically because of a poor cost-benefit ratio. And so we thought, well, that's it, you know, it just got shot down.
So the Tokarskis went about their business, Sandra working at an art store in Bloomington and Thomas working at Indiana University in the School of Optometry. But during the summer of 1990, the Tokarskis went to a planning meeting at the local fairgrounds. The plans for the Indianapolis to Evansville or the Southwestern Highway were brought up again. The Tokarskis were under the impression the road had died with the Donahue study, but it was clear the state was determined to build it anyway. Governor Evan Bayh had filed an addendum to the Donahue study that called attention to a number of problems with the original report, And ultimately, it suggested the road would have a significant economic benefit and should be built.
Spend all that money doing the study, doesn't come out the way you want it, so we're not going to forget it, waste all that money, and we're going to do it anyway.
The night of the planning meeting, the Tkarskis wrote a letter to Senator Richard Lugar explaining how the road was a bad idea for Indiana.
And then we started talking to neighbors, and, people were outraged. We couldn't, we wanted maps. We called the county engineer. He didn't have a map. We called NDOT. They didn't have any maps. They're going to build a multi-billion-dollar highway, and they didn't have any maps. So anyway, what we did is we got together. We called friends, Brian Garvey, who lives about a half a mile that way, and some other neighbors that lived down Evans Road. We said, well, let's get together. And we sat around Garvey's kitchen table and talked what we were going to do. And Brian Garvey is a wonderful graphic artist, and he drew up a little flyer. We went around door to door with our petition, giving people the flyer. We got a notice in the paper.
Garvey was part of a small group that planned to gather at a nearby firehouse in October 1990.
I mean, it is the thing about NIMBY, not my backyard. I mean, that's where everything begins, you know. Typically, you personally feel something about an issue, and that's how you can personally become involved in it.
Short note of disclosure, Garvey's wife works at the producing station of this documentary. She is not involved in news reporting. Garvey was one of nearly 200 people who attended that first meeting to get information and learn about the latest plans for building the Southwestern Highway. The highway project now had organized opposition. The Tkarskis and Garveys wanted to pick a name for their group that didn't suggest they were angry anti-road people. They wanted something that would show they valued quality infrastructure, but they questioned the value in building new roads when existing ones could be repaired or upgraded. They settled on CAR, Citizens for Appropriate Rural Roads.
Tom and Sandra are expert grassroots organizers.
That's Andy Knott. He was a policy director at the Hoosier Environmental Council and spent a lot of time working with CAR and the Tkarskis.
I mean, they get it. They understand what it takes.
The Tkarskis are longtime environmental activists. Thomas was arrested in the 1970s for protesting the construction of the Marble Hill nuclear facility on the Ohio River in Louisville. His arrest helped publicize the dangers associated with the plant. And the plant that was once considered a done deal ultimately wasn't built. The Tkarskis had similar success a few years later, showing that the former Westinghouse plant in Bloomington had dumped hazardous waste into limestone quarries and garbage dumps. Building on that experience, they began circulating petitions, visiting county fairs, and learning everything they could about transportation policy. These were the days before the internet, though, and the Tkarskis really didn't know what they were up against. They were still under the assumption that the proposed road would be an Indiana highway. They had no idea that it had grown to a proper superhighway connecting nations. So on one side, CAR was essentially unaware what was going on. Meanwhile, the proponents of the road were gaining momentum. They'd formed their own organization called the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition. And thanks to the efforts of David Graham, the group eventually had important supporters from many of the cities and states along the route. In November of 1991, I-69 made it into a federal transportation bill. This meant I-69 had a political heartbeat. It admittedly was faint since there was no money for the road, but it was beating.
The people involved in the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition early on were smart people, very active in their community, but they weren't necessarily savvy about how to go about building a huge interstate. And who can blame them? Because no one had really tried this before.
Again, author Matt Dellinger.
They kind of were rolling along in a semi-naive but very optimistic state for a couple of years, and they had trouble getting Houston involved. There's no real need for us to kind of roll ourselves in with these people from Kentucky and Indiana. That's too complicated. So they initially said no. No, we don't want to join your coalition.
But decision makers in Houston began to have second thoughts when Dallas, Austin, and San Antonio signed on to the project. Houston didn't want the other cities to get all of that traffic.
And that kind of got their competitive juices going, and they said, okay, we'll join the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition. We have to hire some professionals. We need to pay lobbyists. Not a PR person, not a government affairs person, a lobbyist, a guy who's going to sit there when the bill's being written, stand over the shoulder of the, you know, congressional aide, that kind of work, the kind of nitty-gritty that you need to get what you want into bills.
The Houston Chamber of Commerce recommended the coalition hire Tom DeLay's brother, Randy, as a lobbyist. Randy DeLay understood how to navigate the political process and how to play the game when necessary.
If you're a congressman and you've got a lot of people asking you for a lot of things, gee, maybe you're more inclined to listen to the person who just wrote you a check or held you a fundraiser. And there was a lot of that going on, throwing a fundraiser in Arkansas for a congressman from Alaska who happens to be the head of the House Transportation Committee. So when you look at it all, when you look at all the stuff that went on lobbying-wise, it's pretty clear what was happening.
By this time, the members of CAR had heard rumblings about a NAFTA highway, but they dismissed the idea. However, when they found out about the route making it into a federal transportation bill, they knew the proposed interstate was more than a myth. The Tokarskis started digging. It turns out the environmental impact study was conducted by an early supporter of the road and one of David Graham's friends, who stood to gain a lot if the road were built.
What's interesting is in the case of Interstate 69 in Indiana, the company, that the firm that ended up doing the big statewide study to say, well, let's look at this again now that it's a national project and now that we found these flaws in the Donahue study. The firm that was chosen to do that study was, the new study, was run by Bernardin and Lockmuller in Evansville. And Keith Lockmuller had been one of the primary people on this committee in the Evansville Chamber of Commerce trying to get them to build this road. Here's a guy who publicly stating he wants to build the road. His firm's put in charge of studying whether we need the road.
To some, BLA's involvement was questionable, since according to the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, the study was supposed to be objective. BLA officials refused to be interviewed for this documentary, but in a video produced for the I-69 groundbreaking ceremony, BLA co-founder Keith Lockmuller talks about his involvement in getting the road built.
Wow. I was the director of Evansville Urban Transportation, and I go back as far as maybe 62, 63 talking about some route, straight route up to Indianapolis. So we've been around a long, long time. And I finally see that we're going to build this.
Linton Caldwell was one of the principal authors of NEPA and a highly regarded national expert on environmental policy. He made his home in Bloomington, Indiana, where he was a professor at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs. In the late 90s, he spoke on one occasion about the I-69 study. In a letter to the editor of the local paper, he said the independence and objectivity of the environmental impact statement was suspect, having been prepared by a private consulting firm to, quote, defend the state's badly flawed plan, presumably to give NDOT an impact statement that would support its predetermined preferences. The Tokarskis had read and understood the National Environmental Policy Act. They thought a clause buried in the bill might be their way out. It said a state could not build a road without looking over every possible alternative. It was also required to do the due diligence to see if it was necessary to even build a road in the first place. CAR changed its strategy and came out with a new slogan, No New Terrain. The group was giving up its fight to stop the road and the big-name politicians in D.C. They recognized I-69 was coming, but they were proposing that it take an alternate route through Indiana. When they looked at the map for possibilities the state could consider, they discovered a four-lane route from southwest Indiana to Indianapolis already existed. State Route 41 from Evansville to Terre Haute to Interstate 70 to Indianapolis. The members of CAR argued that upgrading this route to Interstate standards would cost less, meet the goals of extending I-69, and be less damaging to the environment than building a new road. The supporters of the highway believed the current proposed direct route was the most sensible route. Folks like Washington Mayor Tom Baumert and Daviess County Growth Council Director David Cox thought it was a better route because it was shorter.
I drove over to 41 one time and went up to 70 and across to Indianapolis, and whew, that was a long trip. And then if you really start looking at all the businesses and houses that are going to have to be bought and moved or relocated, it's huge. It would have been really, I know it's easy to say, well, upgrade 41 and use that. Well, that's not a direct route.
As you better educate people, they can make more intelligent decisions. And most of these people do not want to be educated. They want to say, I don't care what it is, but I know I'm getting it. And I know as you head a little bit further north, you get into that. And they have their four lane, and we don't.
But to members of CAR, using the existing route from Evansville to Terre Haute to Indianapolis made so much sense, they publicized it as the common sense route. Hoosier Environmental Council Policy Director Andy Knott says the common sense of doubling up I-69 with US 41 and I-70 lay in the relatively minimal impact on the land.
The common sense route would not go through the Patoka National Wildlife Refuge. It would not go through any karst area, through any area where there are caves. The impacts on wetlands were dramatically less. It's a no-brainer to use that route. And there, a lot of things led up to that. There was, you know, a lot of national news coverage. NBC did the Fleecing of America piece. ABC did a It's Your Money piece. There was starting to become a lot of national attention to this boondoggle, really.
Friends of the Earth did at that time a Green Scissors report, which is focusing on projects that are damaging to the environment and damaging to the taxpayers' dollars. And we had Arnold the Pig come, and we made a giant check and for whatever the cost of the highway was, and Arnold the Pig used the scissors to cut that up. It basically was a pig's outfit that Andy had rented from someplace.
The EPA responded and called for a new environmental impact study. If there were a better route that would be less damaging to the environment, the EPA thought NDOT should consider it.
I felt vindicated that these agencies were, you know, agreeing with something we've been saying for years.
While the opponents for a new highway felt vindicated, the original supporters of the road from Washington, Indiana, were fearful. If the state had to look at other routes, then the highway they'd been working so hard to build for so many years might not go through their community. NDOT agreed to the public outcry and to the EPA's recommendation. They called for another study. There would be two goals. One, determine whether the road should be built. And two, what route it would take. The state also came up with a new purpose and need statement. Provide a new road that strengthens the transportation network in Southwest Indiana, supports economic development in Southwest Indiana, and completes the section of the National I-69 project between Evansville and Indianapolis. Members of CAR felt the purpose and need statement slanted the study toward the new terrain route. Again, author Matt Dellinger.
If you make the purpose and need of the interstate to connect Evansville and Indianapolis as directly as possible, well, that certainly points to one route over another, doesn't it? I mean, if the purpose and need was to enhance mobility while protecting the environment, that logic would go through the objective numbers to another conclusion. But as long as you have the stated purpose of the study to find the route that will most directly connect, you're going to end up choosing the route that most directly connects. The state said, well, they have all the expertise. Of course, we're going to hire them again. Opponents said, hey, wait a minute. Didn't they screw up once? Can't we get someone else? But Bernard and Lockmuller went and started a new study, which is bigger than a phone book, had to do with how many trees, how many wetlands, how many Indiana bats, how many this and that. the only meaningful numbers to the people who were eventually going to decide where to put I-69 were the numbers about economic development and number of miles.
Under the National Environmental Policy Act, there has to be a public comment period. But the Hoosier Environmental Council's Andy Knott says there was never much attention paid to road opponents.
It just seemed like they would always downplay the opposition, and that was always very frustrating. And again, I think that was just political. I mean, there was so much behind the scenes support for the project that they couldn't acknowledge that the majority of people were opposed to it.
The Tokarskis were among the opponents who always attended the public comment hearings to voice their opposition.
It's really important for citizens to be involved as much as they can, as much as we can. And that means doing all those boring things like going to meetings, you know, writing letters to elected officials, writing letters to agencies, writing letters to the editor.
But unfortunately for the Tokarskis, the study was not an act of curiosity.
Author Matt Dellinger.
It was not about, you know, let's figure out what the right thing to do is. It was essentially paperwork that the state had to do, and they were ticked off that they had to do it again. And you get that sense in all of the hearings if you watch the hearings from 2002, I mean, person after person is standing up and giving an impassioned speech about why they think that the road through Terre Haute, it's only 8 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever longer. It's half the cost. You save the towns along 41 from obliteration. There were all of these pretty compelling reasons, if you were an objective viewer, for seriously considering 41 and 70.
I never did think it was the time saved. I always thought it was the safety factor involved. And I kept saying, well, you know, you're talking about environmental impacts. Look, when they build an interstate, they build those environmentally friendly. Right now, all of our ditches out here, if you'd have a major spill from a semi or something, it's going to go right down the ditch to the creek to the river. These interstates, they're built to stop them right in the general area. They're not built to let them flow everywhere.
Tom Bomber was sweating it out because it seemed like another route was seriously being considered.
There was a few times when we'd all come to a quickie meeting somewhere and say, hey, we're in trouble here. It looks like they're trying to direct this some other direction. We've got to derail this thing. And there was no simple way to derail it. You had to wait till the environmental impacts come out.
During his time in office, Bomber raised money to restore the city's parks, buy a new fleet of city vehicles, build a new water treatment plant. The list goes on and on. All of these things Bomber did with one goal in mind, improving the future for his kids and grandkids. Bomber was at a conference in Indianapolis not long after taking office. Governor O'Bannon's wife, Judy, was delivering the closing remarks, and she challenged the officials sitting in attendance to look in the mirror every day and ask themselves what they did to make the world better for their grandkids. If the answer was nothing, then they should be ashamed of themselves. Bomber says that message stuck with him. He thought about it the whole drive back to Washington, and after that made it one of his goals to do something every day that would benefit his grandkids. Bomber understood where some highway opponents were coming from and agreed he wouldn't want an interstate cutting through his backyard either. But Bomber was pleading for folks to remember this was about something bigger. The fear in Washington was they wouldn't get the road, and the people in Terre Haute and south along 41 would see the economic impact they'd been fighting for so long to bring to their town. There was precedent for this sort of thing. Washington had been passed over for a road before, so longtime residents knew the governor could and potentially wouldn't hesitate to change the route. Again, David Cox.
Look at Seymour, Indiana. Several years ago, Seymour, Indiana and Washington, Indiana were the same size. They both were on US 50. They both were on the B&O Railroad. Well, then here come the interstate through, and it went east of them, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles. And the city of Seymour prepared for that. They started running sewer and water out there. And if you look now, they grew to the interstate. So the same thing would apply here along I-69.
There's no doubt that the interstates changed the development patterns in this country immensely.
Matt Dellinger.
Not only did it kind of pick winners and losers as the routes were made, but it also brought people, it made it easier for people to move from the cities out into the suburbs. It created an enormous amount of economic activity.
Ultimately, in 2003, Governor Frank O'Bannon didn't choose the 41-70 route. It wasn't even considered a finalist.
Let me just say this, that this is the best route for Indiana for all factors considered. And let me assure you, everyone has been examined.
Bloomington Representative Matt Pierce says the road has always been about playing politics.
It's a simple calculation. When people run for statewide office, if it's governor, there are a lot of voters down in Vandenberg County, the Evansville area. And the politicians, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, have concluded in order to get a nice majority, particularly if you're a Democratic candidate in a somewhat Democratic Evansville area, if you're going to get that vote, you need to be for the highway. They perceive people in Evansville as really wanting that highway badly. And so most statewide office holders tend to become very strong proponents of I-69. And it's all designed to get those votes at election time.
Evansville would, after all, get its direct route to Indianapolis, winding through Washington and the Tokarskis' backyard. For each acre of farmland, forest, or wetlands eliminated to make room for I-69, 3 acres would be mitigated as required by federal regulations. New wetlands would be created, forests planted, and farmland restored to its natural state. 5,000 acres of new nature preserves would exist across Indiana as a result of I-69.
Humans, I'd like to think that we can do a lot of good things, but recreating nature so far is not one of them.
Mitigation is expected to cost about $77 million, and the company doing much of the legwork is Bernardin, Lockmuller & Associates, the Evansville firm involved in the project since its planning stages, and the company that, to this point, has earned more than $56 million from contracts related to I-69. Despite Governor O'Bannon's choice of a direct Evansville to Indianapolis route for I-69, Carr and other opponents continued to fight the highway. They filed several unsuccessful lawsuits and tried to persuade lawmakers to change the route. But their best weapon in this fight was money, or a lack thereof. State and federal officials could make plans to build the highway, but they had no way to pay for it. Federal transportation laws had shifted the burden of highway funding back to the states, and with the recessions of the mid-2000s, the states were broke. Author Matt Dellinger says that served as sort of a comfort to the major opponents of the road.
They had a very strong argument for many, many years that this was something that the state could not afford. They knew that no matter how, Evansville friendly a governor was, how unfriendly to the environment a governor was, they always had that money thing to let them sleep at night. Well, but they can't pay for it. There's no way they can pay for it. It could go onto the books, but it's never going to be built.
In 2005, Mitch Daniels was sworn in as the 49th governor of Indiana.
I will urge that our purpose be bold, that if we err on the side of action, of movement, of experiment.
Right away, the Republican governor began looking for ways to cut spending and increase revenue without raising taxes. One thing he'd been closely looking at was public-private partnerships, particularly as they related to highways. A number of banks were interested in the idea of leasing state roads. These investors would give the state large sums of money up front to help them with their struggling budgets. And in turn, the investors could turn a profit by tolling highways and raising the fees on existing toll roads, something a governor could politically never do.
He worked, I believe, in the Reagan White House. He was the budget director for George W. Bush. So he was a policy guy. I mean, he really knew his stuff. When he was running for governor was kind of this moment where a lot of overseas banks were trying to get this idea of privatization and leasing of toll roads off the ground here. And they were making visits to many state houses and talking to Congress people. And the idea, you know, I was doing my reporting at the same time, and I was watching in Texas in 2002, Governor Perry running for re-election and saying he wanted to build this big system of private toll roads, and everyone was kind of, yeah, well, whatever, that's pie in the sky.
Daniels had said a toll road or no road when he came into office. He sent his staff from MnDOT down to Texas. Here's what's going on in Texas, and we're talking about the whole Trans-Texas corridor with this, you know, huge quarter mile wide right of way, privatized with rail and with all the utilities and, you know, a whole big ball of wax. I remember being 2005 at the county fair saying, look it, we can't say for sure, but connect the dots here. We think this is what he's going to do.
And
sure enough.
And people laughed at us. They said, oh, this will never happen in Indiana. No way he's ever going to do that.
Never going to do that. And guess what?
Guess what?
Not 6 months later, he had jammed that thing through the legislature.
That came as a surprise to longtime highway proponents like David Graham.
Mitch was a friend of mine, and I knew that he was a doer, but I did not know about the highway.
Governor Mitch Daniels.
I didn't get up one morning and say, wouldn't it be fun to lease a state asset? I stayed up nights for a long time, realizing that Indiana was $3 billion or more dollars short of the money it needed to keep its promises to communities all over the state. It had really been a rather cynical exercise. Politicians had promised all kinds of roads and bridges and things, and I would meet these folks with these yellowed pieces of paper, you know. After looking at about three dozen options, it was clear the only one with the potential to generate enough money to keep our promises, keep the state's promises to people everywhere was the lease, if it worked, and it worked.
Just politically speaking, it's a touchy thing to privatize something that is physical, that you can actually see.
Author Matt Dellinger.
You're not privatizing some backroom, back office process. You're privatizing a road. And it's easy to kind of forget now how difficult that was for Daniels. He passed it through the legislature with one vote. His approval ratings kind of went through the floor. I think he was booed at an Indiana Pacers game. I mean, this was a controversial thing.
Daniels leased the Indiana Toll Road to a Spanish-Australian firm for $3.85 billion. He dedicated $700 million of that money to build Interstate 69 from Evansville to the Crane Naval Center. The legislation, called Major Moves, was for early supporters of I-69 just that, a major move in the direction of getting their highway built.
We would be up in Indianapolis meeting with the NDOT people, and they'd say, we recognize how important it is, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but we don't have any money. And so we come back and our head in our hands trying to figure out how we're going to raise more money, and then here comes Major Moves. I said, ah!
I was very surprised, and of course, pleased as punch to finally have the money to get started.
Major Moves was a blow to the opponents trying to stop the highway, who were hopeful a fiscally conservative Republican governor would overturn the previous Democratic governor's direct route for I-69.
Now, what we're out to do is to bring some hope and life to some of the poorest parts of Indiana.
They had thought Daniels would go with the cheaper route through Terre Haute.
Governor O'Bannon chose the route after the usual years and years of exhaustive study that we do in this country. Nobody else does it the way we do, but believe me, after all those years, everything that could be said had been, and Governor O'Bannon chose that route. The important thing to remember about the route is that to have tinkered with it afterward would have started the whole clock over again. So people who said different route meant no road ever. If it had been a decision for me to make, might I have picked some other route? I might have. I certainly listened. I met with everybody, including the diehard opponents, multiple times. But it was a binary choice. We can say this is a dumb law. I think, frankly, it is. A lot changes in 10 or 20 years since the first impact statements and all were done. But it is the law.
In all their years protesting I-69, the Dukarskis say they've never done anything that wasn't protected as free speech. So it posed quite a problem when a group of national environmental activists swooped into town to join the fight. Many longtime opponents welcomed youthful energy to the fight, but these more radical environmentalist actions often involved civil disobedience.
They weren't interested in lawsuits and petitions and the normal kind of political process. They wanted to take what they called direct action.
Author Matt Dellinger says their actions were motivated by a fear that the NAFTA highway would lead to globalization and a loss of American jobs to Canada and Mexico. Their direct action approach to protesting included carrying flaming torches through Bloomington, dumping over trash cans, and protesting outside the homes of the road contractors.
When this all started happening in Bloomington, the Dukarskis had a hard time with it because they, as people, were so strongly associated with trying to stop I-69 in a lot of people's minds that they were getting phone calls and people saying, look, if this continues, if you're behind this at all, if you're even friendly to it, we don't want to be any part of your organization anymore. So the Dukarskis sort of had to distance themselves from the anarchists and while at the same time saying, you know, we agree that I-69 shouldn't be built.
When the state started construction on Interstate 69 in 2008, there was a groundbreaking ceremony in Evansville. It was a huge event with a band, catered food, and lots of folks who in some cases had spent decades fighting for I-69. The Dukarskis were there, but they weren't allowed inside.
I thought I was in a third world dictatorship.
Security had been heightened amid fears that protesters might get violent.
I mean, that place was surrounded by armed policemen and God knows what, who all. They had snipers on the roof. Sam doesn't like to call them snipers, but there's guys up there on the roof with their glasses and stuff. They had buses with bomb sniffing dogs in them. They had buses to carry people off, you know, massive numbers of people to get arrested. When is it all of a sudden that we're so afraid of protesters?
The protesters were certainly in the minority. There were only a dozen or so, while the supporters numbered more than 1,000. Representatives from across the country, from all levels of government, celebrated the historic moment. Governor Daniels addressed the crowd from behind a podium, emblazoned with an Interstate 69 road sign.
Today, we end the interminable waiting, the unfulfilled hopes, the empty promises.
Although Governor Daniels was the person who got the money to finally make the road happen, he recognized it was the folks in Washington, such as Tom Baumert, David Graham, and David Cox, who deserved the credit for keeping the idea alive through five governors.
I don't think it would have happened without them. They soldiered on year after year, decade after decade, and never gave up. I would think that those people who still disagree with the road would have to admire the citizen tenacity of a grassroots group that just had a dream of how their, again, struggling part of the state might do better and kept on pursuing it. So I think the idea probably would have died more than once along the line if they hadn't been so tireless and determined.
We've had the cows up to the gate before and they bolt and run.
Again, David Cox.
We've been close before, but when they start unloading bulldozers, then we thought we had a pretty good chance.
The first portion of I-69 was underway. It was less than 2 miles in Gibson County, but its significance was immeasurable. A year later, the first cars would begin driving on I-69.
I used to say that I'm going to be an old man sitting in the back seat slobbering over myself whenever they drive me on I-69. But, you know, I might actually drive my own car and drive this thing yet.
That was former Washington Mayor Tom Baumert. In all, I-69 includes 6 sections. The first section connects Evansville to Oakland City. The second section includes Daviess County and Baumert's hometown of Washington. The third section connects the Crane Naval Center to I-69. The fourth section includes Crane to Bloomington. The fifth section connects Bloomington to Martinsville. And the final, sixth section gets I-69 to Indianapolis. The money from major moves was intended to fund I-69 for the first three sections, or to Crane. But it was left up in the air how the other three sections would be funded.
So he throws 700 some million to get I-69 rolling.
CAR member Brian Garvey.
And I think it's to get the footprint down. So in other words, we've gone this far, we're not turning back now.
I did tell the engineers, look, let's get a functional road. You can always add to it later, but I don't want to take any more land than we have to. I don't see the need to build one, build a Cadillac if a good solid Jeep or Chevy will suffice for 20, 30 years.
Essentially, that means the road won't be as thick as, say, I-65 or I-70. It'll be thinner, with the idea that crews can always come back and add to it later.
You don't build it this thick when this thick will do for 20 years.
Construction has to be conducted according to state and federal standards. And although the Federal Highway Administration makes recommendations and has to sign off on any design exceptions, a great deal of discretion is left to the state.
Mitch Daniels essentially said, throw out the rule book. It's substandard building.
Again, Brian Garvey.
One of the workers on the road said, we're calling it State Road 69 because of the cost cutting being done in terms of standards set for interstate highways. Everything from incline, everything from bed layment, no medians, cable, et cetera, et cetera.
But that still wasn't enough to get the project back on budget. Improving access to small towns was a big case for building the interstate. NDOT decided it needed to postpone building some planned exits in order to cut costs.
One thing that definitely affects which towns will win or lose when a new interstate is built is where the exits are.
Two ramps in southwestern Indiana that were included in the original I-69 plans were deferred and could be eliminated. This saved the state more than $30 million, and it made the exits that were still planned even more valuable to those communities. Washington, the home to some of the earliest highway supporters, would be the only town on I-69 with an on-off ramp along a stretch of about 30 miles.
Washington becomes a big winner.
That's Matt Dellinger.
I mean, that's going to direct a lot of the development along I-69 to that very small piece of land, which is owned by the Graham family.
David Graham.
The highway opens up a whole new vista for people and a whole new vista for trade.
Building first-class public assets is a core function, I think, of government, and really part of creating an environment of opportunity that the one we want Indiana to be known for.
The road is now back on track.
I-69 is 8 years ahead of schedule and under budget. The sections 1, 2, and 3, which are under construction now, some of it's finished. We're budgeted at $700 million, and right now we're at $578, and there's one more contract to go.
The savings added up, and Governor Daniels says the road will make it to Crane ahead of schedule and within budget. From there, the road will continue into Monroe County and join Highway 37. Before the state could put the section from Crane to Bloomington into its long-range plan, it had to identify how it would be funded. The major moves money allocated to I-69 will be gone at the completion of Section 3. So Governor Daniels is turning to traditional sources. Traditional funding is a combination of things, but largely federal and state gas tax revenues. After Section 4, it's unclear how the road will be funded from Bloomington to Indianapolis.
We're in a position to complete Sections 1 to 4, it's called, but really get to 37. And as I said, by the time you've done that, you've created much of the functionality of the whole road, since 37 itself is a good road now. I wouldn't try to prejudge what a future governor should decide. Should it be 5% or 10% or 20% of
of a year's highway budget till it's completed.
But the next governor could also decide I-69 is not worth the investment. Carr and the Tokarskis are hoping the next governor will be more fiscally conservative than Daniels. But regardless of the next governor's ideology, he will be faced with a list of road projects that's more than 130 pages long and includes well over 900 projects. It'll be up to the next governor to review all of these competing projects and decide which, including those tied to I-69, get funding. Meanwhile, in Washington, former Mayor Tom Baumert is simply urging the naysayers to wait and see.
I think once it's completed and people use it, they're going to say, wow, somebody really did good back in the old days to get this going. And I know when I started on it, I was black-headed. I'm not black-headed anymore.
The Tokarskis, meanwhile, have been equally dogged, devoting more than half of their married life to organizing grassroots opposition to I-69. They still attend all the public hearings, making their case against the highway.
There is no responsible oversight in this project. It's too politically driven, and the agencies will not buck the politics, and there is a serious lack of oversight.
And it's hard because you tell people, be involved, make a difference, but then you're going to have to tell them, well, you can be involved, but it ain't going to make a difference. You know, it's hard, and we really have lost something important here. And this is a democratic process that we should be very concerned about losing. And the politicians, they don't care. They're about power and money.
It won't be very long before people don't remember who the heck was governor back now, but they will be driving on roads and enjoying some scenic protected wetlands and things like that that I'll always know we had a hand in.
NDOT estimates the total project cost for the I-69 corridor to be $3.1 billion. Opponents estimate the cost is actually closer to $4 billion. The road is slated to extend from Mexico straight through to Canada, thanks in part to a path of influence stretching from Washington, Indiana to Washington, D.C. Whether it was a confluence of extraordinary circumstances, the right people connecting in the right places at the right times, or a pork project pushed by political insiders, I-69 has left a growing footprint on the entire landscape. I-69 Are We There Yet? Was executive produced by Sarah Whitmire, with assistance from Wes Akers, Gretchen Frazee, Joe Wren, Mia Partlow, Kyle Stokes, Stan Jastrzebski, Dan Goldblatt, Jason Pear, and Bill Shaw. Special thanks to Matt Dellinger, author of Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway, the City of Washington, Indiana, Mary Smith, John Bailey, and Micah Schweitzer. Executive in charge is Perry Metz. This has been a production of WFIU WTIU News.